Good evening. I just want to publicly wish Elliot, you know, long life. I married a South African, and the minhag in South Africa is when somebody passes away in New York, like you wish them a long life. And I'm sure many of you know Elliot just lost his father. Just got up on Friday, really on Shabbos. So I just want to wish him. All of us have simcha, and it's really I want to say and should have good memories, and should all have a long life. And I'll let him take away and run the rest of the program.
Good evening, and welcome to the second in our series of faith lectures or faith dialogues. That's going to continue over a number of years. Our first one was last month with Rabbi Dr. Abraham Twersky, and tonight it's really my pleasure to introduce to you Professor Lawrence Schiffman, who's the chairman of New York University's Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies, and he's the Ethel and Irvin A. Edelman Professor of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. When we do these faith lectures, we give a professional, we also give a little bit of a personal introduction. So I'll just tell you that Professor Schiffman was born in May 1948, which is a resonant date in Jewish history. And he was born in Manhattan. He was schooled as a child in public school and afternoon Hebrew school, and then went on to Hebrew high school. He did all of his degrees at Brandeis, finally coming out with his PhD in 1974. And he's basically been at NYU for 36 years. And he's been the chair at NYU for the last 12. He's married. He has a boy, three girls, six granddaughters, one grandson. And they live in New York and in Israel. And in New Jersey, okay. And, of course, as you know, Professor Schiffman is really one of the world's leading authorities on the Dead Sea Scrolls and the entire period of Second Temple Judaism. His publications are simply enormous, far too long to list here, and he's served, as well as his academic duties, as the director of NYU's program at the Archaeological Excavations at Dor Israel. He's been a visiting professor at Yale, at Ben-Gurion, at Duke. And, of course, he was the Shire visiting professor at U of T just a few years ago. So tonight we wanted to sit down with Professor Schiffman and talk about, again, certain issues of faith, but this time ones that revolve around his career in the academy and the kinds of issues that emerge from teaching Jewish studies. In the first part of our dialogue, we'll speak somewhat biographically, and then we'll get on to some of the more professional issues. I was interested when you sent me a bio that you went to public school and then afternoon Hebrew school. Was that normative at that time? Or?
Well, let's put it this way. Where I grew up, there was a rather bad day school, and my parents didn't even consider going to such as too close, too far. Didn't think it was worth going to it, whether rightly or wrongly. I didn't go to it. And in those days, there still were Hebrew schools where you could learn Hebrew. I had the same teacher. I had a woman who was one of these old-fashioned Hebrew teachers. And I had the same woman for, I think, 5 out of 6 years. And then again in high school. And actually, we learned Hebrew. And we also studied Mishnah and Gemara. It was a very different atmosphere than what exists today. I know when I went, before coming to NYU, I spent 1 year in the University of Minnesota. And they had the Minneapolis Talmud Torah, which was very reminiscent of that kind of thing. But today, I guess it's more or less gone.
As you're saying, it was a serious afternoon.
Yeah,
it was an oxymoron today.
Yeah,
really.
They say it's an oxymoron. It's not our subject today. But, you know, 50% of the Jewish children in America are going to continue to get their education in some type of an afternoon school. And the community is just writing it off like, you can't do anything, and if we write them off, we're writing off a lot of people.
And what was it like at home? How did your parents feel?
My parents were sort of the old-fashioned right-wing conservatives, the kind that don't exist anymore. I guess I shouldn't say were. My mother still is. And so, you know, the Jewish normative stuff was a big part of life. On the other hand, the educational level, in terms of understanding of what I guess we would today call the details, maybe minutiae, maybe much more than that, of things that we take for granted or I take for granted, right? They didn't really have any kind of education that they had. Was, you know, you learned how to daven and, you know, that's it. And, you know, then you basically knew nowhere near what we consider to be normative today.
So do you remember when you were a child going to sort of big conservative synagogues, that type of thing? And what about internally? Were you curious about God? Did you think about these kinds of matters?
Or? No, I don't know if I really did. That is to say, you know, I think you are taught to live in a certain way or to believe certain things. They tell you these things. And I was thinking about it because you had given me some warning of the types of questions you wanted to ask. And it occurred to me that the idea that there was a God was not a subject for discussion. It was considered one of those types of facts, and I use that word on purpose, facts that are not subject to your determination if they're true or not, but nonetheless are assumed to be facts. An example of that would be that I have absolutely no ability to determine independently whether water is made of H2O, you know, two hydrogen and what. I have no way. I don't even know how they even know, because I forgot all that stuff from high school or something like that. But the point is that we all assume that this is true in the same way. There's a God. You assume there's a God, and that's how things work. And I don't know whether I had any particular interest beyond that, you know, and you learn how to say Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam or whatever it is, or Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem. I don't know whether it was really a subject for much discussion.
Right.
And so I, you know.
How did that, obviously somewhere along the line you morphed into somebody who took on, you know, more observance. Where did that happen? How did that happen?
I don't know exactly to identify some specific point or something like that, but it sort of always happened. So in other words, that is to say that, you know, I was keeping more than they were already in high school. I was in Israel when I was in high school for a summer and things like that. So I don't know if I identify some particular point or event or something like that.
But going to Israel instilled a feeling in you that you wanted to do more Jewishly?
Yeah, but I already was. I mean, in other words, you know, I was putting on tefillin and davening, you know.
And so I'm just trying to locate where that influence came from.
Probably from the home, doing not only the stuff that they said to do and did, but doing the stuff that they said to do and didn't do.
Uh-huh.
It sounds funny, but that's it, you know. I mean, that's the reality of that kind of way of looking at things.
And what prompted the decision to start going into actual work in Jewish studies?
Well, this is very funny, actually. I didn't know that you really could do this. I didn't know that it existed. And I went to Brandeis. I knew I wanted to take a lot of courses in this area. I went to Brandeis, and the first week there was a seminar given by Nachum Sarna, which was on the subject of being in this field. And I walked out of that seminar and said, I want to do this. So I think it was about 3 weeks later I went to see him, and I said, well, you know, can you really do this? So he said, look, I'll tell you how to find out. See whether for the next month you can just do nothing but studying all day. If you can do nothing but studying all day for a month or so, then you can do this, right? So, and he was right, and it worked.
And and the Second Temple period, when did that fascination begin? Was that
into the Second Temple period in a funny way. Remember that this was a period in which, in those days, in academic Jewish studies, many of the areas of the field were not covered. They didn't exist. Nobody taught them. So I had one course in Second Temple stuff with Nachum Glotzer. I'll never forget this experience, actually, because it was like there were four people in the class, and on some level, when compared to what we would talk about today, it was like really primitive. It really was. And it was what he had learned in Germany, you know, in 19, who knows, 20 or something like that. And in any case, at the same time, I was doing mostly stuff in Bible and in rabbinic literature. And then I wrote a senior honors thesis on the Dead Sea Scrolls, just as a sort of fluke, and then I decided I was interested in it. So it's hard to identify, but one of the things that people said to me was that you should find a field in which you could use your interest in Tanakh and Gomorrah, etc., simultaneously. And so that was, Dead Sea Scrolls was perfect for that.
What was the first exposure to Dead Sea Scrolls? Like, how did you?
The first exposure was this independent study senior honors thesis. I'm trying to remember. I took one course in graduate school in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There was only one course, and it was a course in the so-called rule of the community with Liszt's commentary. And that commentary is really a tremendous thing, even until today. It's not used very much. And this sort of got me started on it, and then I just went from there with it. It became my major interest.
It's been, I guess, 60 years now since the discovery.
You got it.
And I know that it's had a very monumental impact in terms of academic scholarship. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, since for most people, I still think the Dead Sea Scrolls is something a little bit foreign, a little bit almost mythical. They don't know about it. It seems obscure to them. I wonder if you could describe for us what you see as its importance, especially for the ordinary Jew, for the believing and practicing Jew.
Well, to start with, one has to ask a question like, how come the interest in the Dead Sea Scrolls is so amazing? I just, within the last couple of months, was twice in San Diego with having a Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. And you see these enormous numbers of people, Jews, Christians, lining up there to see the scrolls. What is there about it? And it's clear that to a great extent, the scrolls are a visible, or we could say readable, tie to a period which is exceedingly important in terms of an intermediary between the Bible and, for us, the Mishnah and the Gemara. And for the Christians, of course, between our Tanakh and the New Testament. And it makes that world come alive in a lot of ways. But now the irony is that much of the material itself is at odds with the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition. And yet, despite that fact, it remains this kind of unbelievable tie to the past. Now, for a lot of people, these are the earliest Bible manuscripts that we have. And that has a kind of a magic to it. And I have to tell you, if you actually touch one of these things for the first time, there is a kind of magic. But having said that, I think that the most important real interest for us should be, and I say should be because I don't know if people are really that sophisticated, should be that it allows us to understand something of the context in which our Jewish tradition, which we call, or it's called scholars call, the Pharisaic rabbinic tradition, the way in which this tradition comes into being in a certain atmosphere. And here we get a little sample of the atmosphere, not even the whole thing, because you have to imagine, like for Second Temple times, you have like a whole wall and 10% of it is painted. And the rest of it, we don't know what was going on. We don't have that much information, but it's clear from the 10% we have that the kind of debates and discussions on all kinds of issues and what was going on in the Jewish community at that time was really complex and really serious, and that what eventually emerges as a kind of a kind of collective decision-making to follow the Pharisaic rabbinic way, that this is a result of a very long and complex process of which we can get a peek at a little part of it. So one of the things that I always say is that I'm not interested in studying a couple hundred weirdos who wanted to go to the desert. The Dead Sea Scrolls are a window on the whole Jewish community at that time, even though it's only a small window, and even though there was much more to that community. But, we like to talk how we don't have sources. Scholars love to say that we don't have any sources about questions. But if you look, Josephus, Maccabees, the so-called Apocrypha, which the Christians kept, so-called Pseudepigrapha, Dead Sea Scrolls, we have an enormous literature. So while we like to say we don't know anything, we know quite a bit. And I think it's filling in that whole picture of that kind of a link. So that's why I think the average Jew should be interested in it. But I'm not sure that the average Jew isn't interested in it, rather for this kind of almost mystical thing that it gives you the chance to see and feel and look at. I tell you what, we talk about the scrolls. If you go to a Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit and you see the piles of dishes that would come out of Qumran, and you realize this is the dishes, literally, that they ate off, 2,200 years ago. It's really amazing, let alone that they read the same the scrolls and the stuff. But it's really amazing. Or tefillin. All these things, it's kind of amazing. You see that they existed and they were being practiced. But by the way, it's a double-edged sword, because it's always being practiced a little differently than the way we did it, sometimes very differently than the way we did it.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Because you mentioned that a couple of times, that there's variance, and I know that you've written publicly that the scrolls provide proof of a different but valid biblical text at Qumran. I'm wondering if you think this poses any problems for normative belief.
Well, look, when you say normative belief, here you get into something that the Rambam talked about, the difference between elite religion and common man religion or whatever it is. Now, I have people coming to see me about every month who went to some programs where they told them various lies to prove that Judaism is true. And they find out that they're lies. And one of the lies they find out is that every Torah is the same. Well, every Torah isn't the same. The Ashkenazim and the Sephardim, and since we have a program coming up about Chabad, Lubavitchers have this Sephardic system of the Pitzua Daka, the one word with the difference between Aleph and Hay. But the Yemenites, right, the so-called Keter Aram Tzoba approach, you know, is it, we have Vayehi Yemei Noach, and this is Breishit Tet, Perek Tet, Pasuk, I think it's Kaftet, but I could be wrong. Kaftet. And there, right, the Yemenites and the so-called Aleppo Kodesh, this is Vayehu Yemei Noach. Every Torah isn't the same, though. A normal person would say, well, big deal. Look what I just told you. It was like the most meaningless stuff under the sun. If the whole Torah were all the same, exactly, over all those years, and this was the only difference, I mean, only a fool, we have Kray and Ketifu, would be worried about it, but they were told a lie. So when you say, you know, what's normative, unfortunately what's normative is a bit uneducated. But if a person studies Talmudic literature, and if they study other texts, even the traditional texts, about the history of the text, they will realize that the history of the biblical text is more complex than that. And you can see in the rabbinic sources evidence of the effort to expunge earlier and more variant texts. And we have sometimes earlier and more variant texts in the Qumran collection. Now, if you go from Qumran to Masada to the Bar Kokhba caves, and you look at the Bibles, you'll see the standardization process, which in my view is in evidence in the rabbinic sources. But you see, the problem is, I don't think, so what you asked me about is an easy answer. And I would say, no, it shouldn't bother any Orthodox Jews or normative, whatever. But there are more complicated questions. Now, first of all, people always ask, well, can you prove or disprove the documentary hypothesis from the scrolls? You can't. The scrolls are evidence of what the Bible was like in a few texts in the 3rd century BCE and a lot in the 2nd and 1st centuries BCE and some in the 1st century CE. That's what it's evidence of. So it's not evidence of what Yirmiyahu did or did not write. It's evidence of what the book of Yirmiyahu was like. So here's the funny problem. If you want to find the earliest text of the Hebrew Bible you can, get a printed Tanakh. The printed Tanakh is an earlier text than the ones in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Say, how could that be? So let me explain. We can understand the history of the Hebrew language by comparing inscriptions, ancient inscriptions that have been found from the biblical period and the Second Temple period. We can determine that over time, the vowel letters, excuse a little bit of technical grammar, but the letters Ahavi, Aleph, Hei, Vav, Yud, increase in use. Those that we, normally the consonants we use them for vowels, they increase in use over time. The less vowel letters you have, the earlier is your text. The Qumran manuscripts of the Bible are later than the ones that underlie the medieval Masoretic text, and some Qumran manuscripts are the ones that underlie the Masoretic text, and just like them, have almost no vowel letters. So that many of the Dead Sea Scrolls are later texts than the one in the Ark, in the Aron Kodesh. And so that's another interesting point here. But where the real problem comes is what I'm going to say. The real problem does not come with that. It comes with the fact that there are varying editions of certain biblical books. Now, you don't have to be so smart to know this. Anybody who reads Divrei HaYamim, and that's almost nobody, the Radak says that nobody learns Divrei HaYamim because it contradicts the rest of Tanakh, which is true. But anyone who would open up Divrei HaYamim will see that Divrei HaYamim has a Shmuel and Malachim underneath it, which is not totally the same as our Shmuel and Malachim. Now, in the case of Shmuel, we got lucky in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And we learn from a combination of certain Dead Sea Scrolls and Josephus' material in Shmuel that there's another version, meaning there were three versions of Shmuel circulating in antiquity. Now, these three versions of Shmuel circulating in antiquity probably go back to ancient recensions, that's a fancy scholarly word for versions of a text, that came into being sometime, now remember Divrei HaYamim is probably edited during the exile, sometime in the last years of the kings. when these books were coming into existence in their final form. So if that's the case, the matter is a bit more complicated. There may be evidence here or there that what the text that became the standard text is a choice that was made about what is thought to be the earliest and thought to be the most accurate version by this ongoing tradition and by the rabbis, but other ones may have existed. And so I don't know, for some people that might cause some kind of great crisis. I don't really see it as much of a great crisis, but for some people it might be.
I hear that. Would it have been troubling to them? In other words, there's different versions floating around, and you're talking about a version of...
Oh, yeah. It's no problem to the people at Qumran because they have more in the library. The rabbis wanted over time to expunge them, so obviously it was trouble to them. The question is what was going on, say for the sake of argument, in the time of the divided monarchy. If people wanted to check up on a text that for us is biblical, for them maybe was or was not, but was somehow assumed to be divinely inspired, because the Bible is obviously a later term of authority. But the point is, if they wanted to check it up, I have no idea whether all those texts would have been the same or not. I can't know. I have no information. Now, if we would find out that they were all different in some radical way, then it might cause us a problem. But we don't really have any such information, and we really don't know.
And what would we attribute the different versions? Would it be that they would just be written down differently by different people?
Well, there are several possibilities. It's possible that a book was edited repeatedly in antiquity. For example, we know Baruch is the scribe of Jeremiah. Now, Yirmiyahu exists in two versions. The one that's in the Septuagint, the Greek translation, of which there underlies, is the Hebrew version that underlies it a little teeny piece, but it can be proven that it underlies it because of the order of certain chapters, right? So we know that there were two versions of Yirmiyahu. Well, maybe Baruch ben Neriah, the scribe, whose seal inscription has been found. But I think it might be one of the ones about which it made this question. It might be a forgery because there's an Israeli criminal case going on right now, and there's some question about whether some of these are forgeries. But in any case, Baruch ben Neriah, who was the scribe, did he only issue one edition? Or did he collect this Nevuah of Yirmiyahu and give it out at one point to some people who wanted to copy it, and then later on, because he worked, that was his job, he got more of the Nevuah of Yirmiyahu and then did it again? Well, I don't know. I just don't know what causes the different orders. Now, so it's possible, as you said in your way of introducing the question, that these are all legitimate additions, but they came about through this kind of process. But there's one other thing let's remember, which was that in ancient times, not everybody thought that the Bible was inviolable, that you couldn't touch the text to touch anything. One of the things we see at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and we don't know, maybe this existed before, is this phenomenon of kind of adapting. You know the story about this Jew who published, everybody must know this joke. This is like joke number 16, everybody laughs. This Jew from Eastern Europe who translated Shakespeare into Yiddish, and underneath she writes, "For Teichter and for Bessert," translated and improved. Well, the point is that they had the feeling that they could improve the Bible. And, you know, this is something that was going on sometimes. The scribes made little changes and stuff like that. So we don't really know if to what extent that may have happened.
Is there, are there variants in the scrolls or in different versions that have any kind of halachic implications?
I think the answer to that is probably no. Well, having said that, there is some evidence. I'll give an example of one that contradicts. I just said no. Maybe I shouldn't have said no. I'm going to give an example. So I wrote a paper about the text in the Dead Sea Scrolls, among other texts, the text in the Dead Sea Scrolls of Iran Idachat. Now, you know the big problem of Iran Idachat. What's going on here? Some people worship idols. So you come in there and you kill all the men, women, and children. Well, wait a minute. What if somebody didn't worship idols? Why is he being killed? Maybe he was a powerless person. He couldn't do anything about it. They said, "We don't care about you. You're going to worship idols anyhow." And he's in the town there. And you come in there, and you're supposed to kill everybody. So what's interesting is that both the Septuagint and the Temple Scroll, which is a kind of adaptation of the Torah at Qumran, both of them add the word "call" everything, everyone, to what makes it Iran Idachat. When it says that the people went astray, right? So they add, instead of Anshei Ha'ir, it's call Anshei Ha'ir. Now, this means that the halakha now becomes that unless everybody went astray, you cannot burn and destroy that entire city. Now, that question is that a halakhic variant? In the paper I wrote, I called it shared halakhic variants. I assume that both the Septuagint and the Temple Scroll go back to a tradition where somebody has modified the Torah to give his halakhic ruling. So this is not necessarily a variant in the Torah text, but it is a variant in the way the Torah text is explained, and the textual variant is introduced in order to make such an explanation. By the way, I never remember where it is, but you know, Rashi has one word in the Bible that's not in our Bible. He has an additional word. And every time I forget and I need to know, I email my son and he tells me, because he remembers where it is. By some reason, I can't remember where it is. But there is the one so that word in Rashi, it's not in our text. It was in his text in the Middle Ages somehow. It's very strange, but it's the case.
So there's a kind of interface that you are talking about, that you kind of represent, where, you know, traditional religion is meeting academic scholarship, is meeting new scholarship. And I've often wondered, you know, how broad or narrow a line that is to walk. So I just wanted to read something to you and to everyone that has really struck me lately. It's a quote from James Kugel in his latest book, How to Read the Bible. It says like this. He says, the modern scholar's agenda calls for studying biblical texts in their historical and cultural environment. The tradition of the Bible's divine character and its role in Bible-based religions have no operational significance in this agenda. And that seems self-explanatory. They don't have religious agendas. They're studying it as a piece of text. On the other hand, writes Professor Kugel, theologians and many ordinary readers often approach the text with a commitment to having the Bible continue to occupy its traditional place in their religions. They want it still to be a divinely given text that speaks to us today. I believe, he concludes, that a growing body of scholars has now come to understand that these two agendas are indeed incompatible. You can't have both. It's going to be a kind of either or. Along these lines, all of us may be familiar with a well-known document that came out a few years ago written by Gil Pearl and Yaakov Weinstein, outlining the perils of university for Orthodox kids. And one of their main targets in the pamphlet was Jewish studies. And indeed, it seems clear to me that they are actually alluding to Professor Kugel when they say, quote, in 1999, the largest undergraduate course in Harvard was a Bible class with a registration of 900 students. 900 students. In the first lecture, the professor, donning a large black kippah, warned those students from religious backgrounds that they may find his class troubling and should think twice about taking the class if they anticipate a severe spiritual crisis. As the semester continued, the students learned that the professor was indeed a sincere Jew who held the Torah in high regard despite maintaining its human authorship. That's the end of the quote. So
One of those two guys was the TA in the class. The one who's not in science was the TA in the class teaching the students the things that he's writing about in this manner.
Everyone should know that.
It's not such a simple matter,
right,
this thing.
Right. So I'm interested here in a whole bunch of things. What Professor Kugel is asserting is that there are certain kinds of intellectual inquiry that are not compatible or reconcilable with maintaining orthodoxy. I guess he's talking about, you know, biblical criticism or analysis of textual variants and so on. So I'm wondering, how do you yourself, Professor Schiffman, with all that you are aware of, and it seems quite clear to me that you are aware of a great deal, in academic understandings of Judaism, maintain a kind of, it's hard to find the words here, a kind of pocket of faith.
So before I start answering this question, you may decide afterwards that everything I'm saying is meaningless, and I just compartmentalized and never really took it seriously. So the problem, you may not agree with anything I say. But let me start with...
We'll let you know.
Yeah. Let me start with a few thoughts about this. First of all, I'm a great believer in the introduction to the Rambam's Morei Nevuchim. And one of the points he makes there is a very simple fact. Let us assume that something is actually a fact. And you have to, we'll make this assumption. So if something is actually a fact, it cannot be against the Torah. Because the Torah can never command a person to believe something false. Now, we had a recent example of this, I don't want to get into this in any depth, with this so-called Slifkin affair. Now, I don't have the independent ability to evaluate the theory of evolution. But it seems to me, from what I know about modern science, that the situation that we're in now is that virtually everything scientists believe is true. And that as science continues, it never in recent times, now that we have real modern science, it doesn't find that its previous beliefs are false. It modifies and sharpens its belief. That's a generally correct statement, which means that it's 99.9% likely that the theory of evolution is true. Okay? It is. Doesn't mean, again, I can't tell you that. I don't know. What do I know? But, therefore, Judaism, in any form, must make possible belief in that thing if it's true. And if it would turn out that you had to reject it, if it is true, then you will have a religion of obscurantism, in which an Orthodox Jew would be commanded to believe that the world is flat, or to believe various other false things that we could come up with. So whatever is factually true has to be possible to be consistent with Judaism if it's factually true. So I attack a lot of these historical issues in the same way. If it's factually true that Mariamne, the wife of Herod, was killed by her husband, then it has to be possible for me to square the incorrect statement in the Gemara that she jumped off the roof herself and killed herself, right, with, in some way. Now, the Rambam himself talks about the very same issue when he says that when you realize that if you find yourself in a contradiction between taking literally some text, biblical or midrashic, and what you know to be true, because he's talking about the college graduate of his day who studied philosophy and he studied, medicine, which is really the same thing, right? So in those days, right, that was what they studied. So such a person in that situation, he says, should not feel pulled between these two things, but should be able to hold both views at the same time and understand that if the other thing is true, if it is a fact, then the Torah is not to be taken literally. Now, that particular position, which is very complex, admittedly, and I'm not necessarily suggesting that one ought to go into the average shul and go out, get up and start telling everybody these things, right? Because they're complicated issues of how you invade people's religious point of view. In other words, do you really want to go out and say to some character who has no equipment to understand this stuff, well, don't take this little that, but having said that, when you take these examples, if certain things would be true, then regarding the history of the Bible, regarding how the Torah came to be, if they would actually be true, we would have to be able to say that we can square them by definition with Judaism. Alternatively, one could say, I don't square with Judaism, I'll abandon being a Jew. I have to say, I'm working on a project with Jim Kugel and Louis Feldman, a Second Temple literature text for the Jewish Publication Society. And I actually remarked, some of you may know Professor Moshe Bernstein from Yeshiva, regarding this very thing, what you're talking about, I remarked to Moshe, I wouldn't discuss it with Jim Kugel. And the reason is because I'm afraid that the discussion would cause him to say, okay, I guess I can't be religious. Because the truth is that this notion that you could say that something which could be factual, if factual, could not be squared with a correct view of Judaism, is in a certain sense the opposite of this Rambam point of view that we're talking about. Now, the problem is that where evolution, or the world being round and not flat, I shouldn't use the word round, the world being spherical approximately and not flat, where they differ from the discussions that we're having about the origins of the Torah, etc., is that we never will be in a position that a theory or a view or something like this, which is being held by scholars, will be virtually provable. And therefore, You will never be in the same in this kind of situation where somebody can say, listen, mister, it is an absolute fact that God never gave the Torah. Because it's not subject to historical proof or non-proof. So this being the case, it's not a question of how do I react to theory A or B. It's rather, how do I react to the possibility that the way the Torah came about may be much more complex than the way we thought it came about.
So I'm assuming that you think what's good for the goose is good for the gander then, so that when people talk about proof on the other side, in other words, on the Jewish side, we can prove X, Y, and Z.
You can't.
You can't.
No, most of the things they taught, it's worse than that. You see, this is like the problem of intelligent design, right? So intelligent design and creationism, they sound like Jewish things. You said average person, we believe God created the world, and we believe that he had an intelligent way of going about deciding, because I think most of us, when we look, we think about our bodies, right? And we think about how things work. It's unbelievable. And you say, well, only some who knows what genius can invent this, right? So we say those things. But the problem is when somebody goes and says, I can prove these things. Now, if you can prove these things, then it's no longer a matter of faith. It's a matter of fact. Now, in fact, and I use that word on purpose, they can't prove these things, right? But the very attempts to prove them are by trying to find some physical thing which is going to prove it. And usually these things are totally unprovable. We could go through a very, very long list of basic Jewish beliefs that are unprovable, but they're not supposed to be provable. You understand what I'm saying? It's like, I'll tell you, I get this crazy episode that somebody was emailing me wildly over and over and over. Will I make the following statement? They want to put this on internet somewhere. He wants to know, will I state whether it is possible or impossible that 4 million Jews walked out of Egypt and marched through the desert? So I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. The Torah says it's impossible. So he was shocked. So because the Torah says it's a miracle. Therefore, it is not rationally possible that that event would have taken place. And we all know that. The question we face is, do we want to believe that the miracle occurred? Not whether we believe it's rationally possible that it would happen under normal circumstances. Under normal circumstances, 4 million people walking through the desert would have no food. That's why the Torah says God sent them food. They wouldn't be able to call up the local takeout and get it delivered as a pizza or something like this. They would have nothing to eat. So everybody knows that if this event actually happened, that they would have starved to death if it wasn't miraculous. So what are you asking whether it could happen? It can't under normal circumstances. So this is a whole big problem. I have to tell you a story. One night I was giving class at the JCC in Manhattan. And when I came out of the class, a woman who is a known Jewish author of actually a book of religious faith came up to me and said, I have to talk to you. She just discovered that many of the things that we believe cannot be proven. I said, well, understand, what do you want to be proven for? She said, well, I want to know it's true. I said, listen, you don't understand the whole thing. Judaism is based on the assumption that besides the value that a human being gets from correctly believing information about what is going on around them, besides that value, well, general knowledge, truth, whatever, there's a value to believing information which can't be proven. The information that can't be proven is what we call faith. Judaism assumes that much of what we believe cannot be proven and that people should have faith in those things. And therefore, sometimes many of us will legitimately question if these things are true. Because why shouldn't a person question if things are true if they're unproven? And then you have to make up your mind. Do you believe them or do you not believe them? But there isn't any proof one way or another for many of the things we're talking about. And anybody who thinks that you're going to find a proof even that God created the world. There is no real proof that God created the world. The question is, do we believe that God created the world based on our evaluation of certain things? And that's what I'm saying. So the answer is, you're right. The goose is, whatever the expression goes, right? Good for the goose, good for the gander, right? And therefore, it bothers me when I hear these silly claims of phony information that are used to prove things. And these characters that are coming to me every once in a while now from these various programs, I don't want to mention the programs, but anyhow, basically certain Kiruv programs, they're coming with this kind of information and then they have a crisis later in life when they find out that the information is not true because they were told that this can be proven and that can be proven and there was never, you know this story. You know what father ever lied to his child? So if they passed it down from generation to generation, that's because Yehuda Levi, the Kuzari. But what do you mean what father ever lied to his child? What are you, crazy? I mean, what kind of a statement is that, right? It's a medieval attempt at proving something which can't be proven.
What how would you think about or approach the Rambam then? Right, the Rambam is saying a number of things that are, I mean, I happen to agree with what you just said, but that's immaterial. The Rambam seems to place different kinds of categories of knowledge here, right? He uses the word know in a context that seems different than the way you're talking about it. And he's also creating a kind of dogmatic structure where you're kind of punished for inability to believe, which seems like a very odd thing emotionally.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the second thing. See, the Rambam assumes, look, we've got to go before the Rambam for a minute. You know, there's all this stuff around that Judaism does not require belief. And this orthopractic idea of Mendelssohn. Now, whatever anybody says, if you open up the first page of Shas and read to the end, and then I'll ask you a question when you finish doing this, right? I'll ask you, we don't want to make you to read the whole Bible because you may come to Divrei Hayamim and have a problem. But anyway, read the whole Shas from beginning to the end. You know, the Vilna Gaon say you want to stay on the first Amud for his whole life, but okay. And we'll go through the whole thing. And then I'll ask you, let me ask you a question here. Is a Jew supposed to believe anything? Who isn't going to figure out that there are certain core beliefs that Chazal expected people would believe, even though they didn't codify it like the Rambam? Now, when the Rambam codifies it, he codifies it because he assumes the following, that if a person doesn't believe these things, they should do something to get them to believe these things. Now, the problem is, can we actually accomplish that? And that's a really serious problem as to whether we can accomplish that or not. And he may be wrong that you're going to accomplish it. And maybe it does no good to say to a person, you're really supposed to believe this. But when you step back one step from that and say, listen, I'm trying to educate a person about what it means to be a Jew. So I may not be 100% successful in teaching that person everything I want, but what should I teach him? And then you look in the Rambam and you will see that most of the things the Rambam says you should teach him are the fundamental ideas which underlie this, the actions. Now, the theoretical idea of orthopractic Judaism might solve the problem of who can have an aliyah in what shul. But there's one problem that it will never solve, which is what is the meaning of these actions we're doing, and why should we waste our time doing them, or money doing them? Why should somebody go out and spend $600 or $800, more than that, you're probably really crazy, but more than that, right, in order to have some leather boxes which have in them some words of the Bible, and why should anybody do this, right? Of course, the better question is, forget about the tefillin. The rest of the bar mitzvah might be costing $50,000. So anybody spend this money? The point I'm making is that you have to ask yourself why. And there is no why without a conceptual framework that underlies Judaism. And so that's what the Rambam somehow or another tried to sum up. Even if we may think that legislating what a person has to believe is a little bit difficult, and as Americans or North Americans, excuse me for the wrong expression, people who live on democracy, we do, it rubs us a little wrong, the idea that somebody will say that we can make legislation that you have to believe A, B, and C. It sounds to us a little bit strange. But what I'm saying is that underneath it is a fundamental group of beliefs that underlie Judaism. Now, maybe these are things that we question. Maybe these are things that we don't necessarily know if we believe. That's a different question. It certainly underlies what the rabbis thought.
You're right, but you're actually talking about two different things at the same time, and I want to split them apart.
Okay.
One of them is, and I think correctly, right, that action that is not informed by some kind of belief structure may be denuded of a certain kind of passion and a certain kind of meaning. Harei ze mishubach. However, the other issue is on the negative side. We have, right, communities now. We basically out people because they don't believe what we believe. We ostracize them. We cut them off. We cut them off if they're not Orthodox. We cut them off inside of Orthodox. And we cut them off because they're not accepting the same packages of belief and therefore not acting on those packages of belief that we do. But if, as you've strongly asserted, that these things are really a matter of faith anyway, you know, it's hard to understand why we would criticize, ostracize, condemn people simply because they don't have the same faith package, which is, after all, somewhat incredibly intangible in the first place. So it seems to me that this, in a way, the entire structure of how Jews relate to each other would be very different.
Well, yeah, but the only problem is you didn't ask me whether I thought that was a good idea. So, okay, I don't think it's a very good idea to do that. right? So, but having said that, you see, this is to some extent political. And look, I don't want to overstate this, but sometimes you have people just don't know what they're talking about, making statements about these things, and they're deciding what should be normative or not normative without having any idea what they're talking about. And not knowing even what may be classical Judaism. I mean, when somebody says that it's heresy to believe that the world is older than 6,000 years, they obviously it's like they've never opened a Jewish text. I mean, this is unfortunately either ignorance or a methodical choice to assert a particular belief which is historically not required, as if it's a required Jewish belief. Now, I can't explain it because I don't know these people personally. I know what they're doing. But this is obviously not a very good idea, and especially not a very good idea. See, the question is, when you start to get into too many particulars and too many details. In other words, we can say that Judaism has certain basic beliefs that the average Jew is, let's say, expected to have, or it would be good if they had, but the question of what action you're going to take when they don't have it is a completely different kind of an issue.
Right. What have you ever had a situation where do students come to you and talk about
students,
faith issues?
Well, first of all, as to faith issues, one came about a week ago, but usually not. A lot of students, first of all, the Orthodox students that we get at NYU are fairly well equipped to deal with these types of issues. Every couple of years I give a talk about some of this to the Orthodox students at NYU. But I have having more people come off the street and call up and say they want to talk about these issues. And this is almost always in the aftermath of bad education or incorrect education by some type of a kiruv organization. That's almost all the ones that come to me. And I would say about one person every month comes off the street. And I usually talk to these people, and sometimes it helps.
And what about kids with a normative day school education? Do they also come to university and sort of have their underpinnings, realigned?
Well, all I know is we've got, I only know the people in my campus,
sure.
Okay? We've got about 400 Orthodox Jews. These 400 Orthodox Jews are grouped in a community that is as if you came to some big shul in a community somewhere. They have a rabbi. They've got a president. They've got 25 different shiurim going on. A lot of them take our Jewish studies courses. A lot of them discuss these issues. They don't discuss it from the point of view of someone who's had some kind of faith crisis. They talk about it as somebody who's trying to create or come to a sense of understanding in an intellectual way their Orthodox commitment. And almost nobody falls away during the 4 years at NYU. So it looks to me, at least like the ones we have, there's very little of a problem of this nature. Now, a lot of these kids also are fortified by good high school educations or programs in Israel where they discuss these issues. Because if you don't discuss them, then it comes as some kind of shock, like this kiruv person. And also, look, what Orthodox Jew doesn't know that Judaism is not monolithic and that there aren't different points of view? They've heard different points of view. They know the different points of view. So sometimes the point of view that they now experience may be a little bit further away or a little bit wider. But also, there's a self-selection process. These people made a decision. This is where they want to go. This is what they want to do. Right? So I don't know if this is really a problem. In fact, maybe we have the opposite problem. Maybe we'd like to see these kids talk a little bit more about some of the conceptual issues in Judaism, and they're mostly worried about, let's put it, whether Hashgacha X of something that just opened up near the campus is reliable or not reliable. But it's a very different world. I mean, like, we have an Eruv now. I mean, this is you're just in a whole other world. So I think we have a wholesome opportunity for people to think about other approaches, but it seems like they seem to know how to do it.
I just want to actually pick up on something you just said about Jewish education. Would you like to see certain things more emphasized even on a high school level? You wrote a piece, which I read about, trying to integrate archaeology into the high school curriculum. Would you say... would you advocate for an expansion of the high school curriculum to include units or even courses that that integrate the findings of archaeology
well,
with the same teaching?
What I advocated mostly is the integration of archaeology into regular Tanakh study or regular Talmud study. I don't think it's realistic. It's an advocate. What are you taking away? Hebrew? They don't learn Hebrew. Jewish history? They don't learn Jewish history. What are we not coming at the expense
right,
of chemistry?
But theoretically, what do you
theoretically,
see as the
I would say, theoretically, I would say that they should kids in Jewish high schools who are the type of high school that they're going to go to a real university, they need to be exposed to all these issues in advance. Now, here again, one has to bring in experts in this type of education to do this in a meaningful and appropriate manner. In other words, I'm not suggesting that somebody start units on Wellhausen in Yeshiva High School, so they will tell them why Wellhausen is false, so when they get to college, they'll know the humanities one professor is wrong. This is not going to work. Because we're dealing with high school, you have to prepare educational materials, you have to know how to do high school education. So you don't really want my decisions on how to do this. But I think that with the proper experts making it happen, it can be a very important way of preparing students for the debates over archaeology. Does archaeology support? Does it detract? All of this kind of stuff. And then when they find that there's a wealth of ideas being debated, they can fit right into that. And you know, one point about these types of issues, the minute you know that there is an open discussion, half of the problem disappears. I'll just tell you a story. Where I live in Great Neck, we have like 25,000 Persian Jews. One of them showed up in Sydney, Australia. In the building, there's this Jewish house, Shalom House or something it's called. And we were staying there, and he showed up there. And it was this old shul right near the place that was being revived by a 20-year-old Lubavitcher with a bunch of Russian immigrants. And we went to the shul, and Shalashudis, this kid, my neighbor, starts asking these really serious faith questions of this 20-year-old rabbi. So anyhow, when the whole thing was over, the guy was saying, look, what am I supposed to do if I'm not sure of this and I'm not sure of this? I said, let me give you my advice. For the next Admeya Vesrim Shana, you should go to Shabbos Mincha like you did this week. And you should bother the rabbi about what you believe or don't believe or you question or you don't question, and you'll be fine for the rest of your life. No problem at all. Meaning, sometimes the discussion of issues is the solution to the issue. And the covering over of the issue makes the issue become a whole different kind of a problem. And I know psychologists will say that, let's say that marriage or something like that. But what I'm saying is, in the questions we're talking about, sometimes all the person who has questions wants to know is that other people have questions. And then they're fine. They can go back to doing the mitzvot and living as a good Jew. But if they think that having the question, if some silly rabbi tells them, if you don't have absolute emunah, that this one, right, then you may as well not be keeping Shabbos. Then the guy says, okay, I won't keep Shabbos.
I just want to switch tacks for a moment. You did an interview last year in the Biblical Archaeological Review, and there you stress that Jews seem to have some wiggle room because we never took the Bible literally, and what you say is surely true. I'm wondering if there's not more to it.
You think it's true? You didn't read the blogs and the people thought it was heresy?
Yeah, I don't read blogs. No,
I don't either. I only read it because about me. I wouldn't read about anybody else.
I'm interested in this this idea of, you know, fundamentalism is basically, it's a Protestant word. It's not a Jewish word. It's been imported into Jewish discourse, but it started with late 19th, early 20th century Protestantism. But Louis Jacobs once wrote something that I thought was quite striking. He says the following. He says, it's been argued that there cannot be a Jewish fundamentalism since traditional Judaism doesn't take the Bible literally, which is exactly what you said. But he says this is really a quibble because he says that the rabbinic interpretation of the Bible is more or less adopted in a fundamentalistic way. Unless you believe that God conveyed directly to Moshe the interpretation of the Bible found in rabbinic literature, you might as well reject Judaism in total. That's what Louis Jacobs says. It seems to me a little overstated, yeah. But there, because obviously we know there's been a development of halakha since the Talmud, but there's something there, right? Doesn't Orthodox Judaism simply, in a way, transfer the ground of authority from a kind of Protestant literalism of the Bible to the authority of Chazal? So that becomes the new kind of fundamentalist ground. And in that way, don't we too adhere to this kind of fundamentalism?
There are a lot of problems with this point of view. First of all, the question, let's start, I take a little time for a moment, but how does the written Torah and the oral Torah, how do the two of them relate in traditional Judaism? There are two ways. The philosophical technique, this is the Rambam. Torah has two parts. 1 + 1 = 2. Okay? So therefore, if you want to know what the Torah means, you have to bring in also the rabbinic tradition. Never mind that the rabbis disagree among themselves, which is why you can't have fundamentalism. This is my problem with what he said. Since they disagree with among themselves, then the fact that you have to combine that with the Torah, and guess what? The Bible disagrees with itself. In case you didn't read the first two chapters of Bereishit, right? And you don't know that, for example, there are two completely different views there about the relation of male and female. Right? In the first chapter, the woman is created simultaneously. And the way the rabbi said that humans are created as one and have to be split apart. The second chapter, the woman's created to serve the husband. Well, I mean, like, what's true? And I can go on forever with this. You know, in the book of Job, there are five positions. The Rambam and the Moreh Nevuchim enunciates that there were five positions on the origin of evil. The last position he identifies as the position of God, by which he means the one that the author of Job put into God's mouth. You know what the Rambam says right after that? You'll never believe it if you don't know. He says, and I say, and begins his interpretation, disagreeing with the author's position that he identifies with God's position. So the point is that if you take the rabbinic tradition and the biblical tradition, and the Rambam says you add the two together, you're not going to be in a very fundamentalist position, because how the heck are you going to do it? Which paragraph is going to be the fundamentalist one that you're going to have to do in the fundamentalist manner, and what Tana are you going to follow in the fundamentalist Talmudic way? Now, the Kabbalistic approach to the relation of the written oral law is completely different. According to Kabbalah, the oral Torah is a gatekeeper. You can't see the written except through the screen, so to speak, of the oral. We look from where we are up through this whole world of the Sefirot, through the supernal Torah which is up there, and therefore when we look through, we see the oral first, and you can only understand the written through the medium of the oral, which is in a certain way of saying, almost, that the whole Torah is really oral. The thing that has authority is oral. Well, now let's go to Jacob's again on this particular approach. So if this is the case, so it doesn't matter to us anymore that the Torah itself disagrees with itself and that the Bible disagrees internally. We only now have the Bible as it's refracted through the rabbis. Good. Open up the rabbinic text again, and according to this interpretation, you're again going to find that the rabbis are arguing constantly about the meaning of that supernal biblical text, and therefore, what's the fundamentalist going to be? But where he's right is, let's say that someone comes along and says, listen here, according to the way the tradition understands these verses, you have to put on tefillin. And you say, you know what? I don't believe that. Now, depends what you mean by I don't believe it. I don't believe that the Torah requires it, but I'm going to do it anyhow. Not so bad. I don't believe you should do it, despite the fact that the rabbi said, so I would argue here that that is not an example of what he's trying to talk about. That's simply a person who says, I don't want to do what they said to do. But they never tell you that you have to believe it's Min HaTorah just because they say it's Min HaTorah. That is not an article of Jewish faith. To believe something is Min HaTorah because the rabbi says it's Min HaTorah is not an article of Jewish faith. There is no requirement that when you do a mitzvah, let's say you think that the requirement of tefillin, like you're a Karaite, and you think that the requirement of tefillin is dreamt up by the rabbis. If you put on tefillin, right, then you still do the mitzvah. So I think that he's actually wrong. Because according to either one of these interpretations, it's going to come out that the problem he's talking about is you still won't have a fundamentalism. Now let me mention one other thing that I mentioned in that interview. Herschel Shanks began that interview by asking us whether or not it was myself and three Protestants, one who went from being a Protestant to being a Reformed Jew but claims not to believe, and another guy who, there were various stories. I don't think it's not worth it now. However, the question he started with was, do you believe in the inerrancy of Scripture? And I said, no. And after the whole thing was being edited, I told Herschel, I have to put an explanation in there. Because the silly Orthodox Jews don't know what inerrancy of Scripture is. They think inerrancy of Scripture means that we believe the Torah is true. That's not what it means. Inerrancy of Scripture means that every single thing which is described, this is fundamentalism, has got to be literally true. Now, if you believed in that, you couldn't be a rabbinic Jew. Because whatever these two interpretations have, you have to have room for the oral law, which is some kind of a modifier, gatekeeper, this, that, and the other thing. Right? If you believe that it's literally true, self-standing the way they do, it's impossible. So I had to put in there an explanation that it's a Christian view. Still, these bloggers that people told me about, so I went and looked at, their view, which is about 8 people, but anyhow, their view was, no, we all believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. They don't even know what it is. That's the point. So people don't realize what's going on. So we, from that point of view, you can't even ask this question. Our point of view about how we take the Bible and the Talmud and the continuing tradition until today and merge it all together and all that is not the point of view of any of these Christians that we're talking about.
So you said in the same interview that you don't believe in pluralism.
Right.
You said, I believe in toleration and mutual respect, but I do believe that certain things are ultimately true or untrue. By this, I take it that you would reject certain claims to truth by, say, Christianity, Islam.
Yeah.
Would you also reject, say, within Judaism, like Reform Judaism?
No, it's exactly the same way. In other words, right, what I'm saying is the following. I am willing to accept the fact that for a whole variety of reasons, I think we all probably have friends in what I'm going to say is true about. This person is a believing Christian, and this makes this person a good person, and it's helped them in their life, and it's good for them. And many of the things that they believe in, we believe in too. And many of the things that they say, we think are true also. And therefore, that's what I mean. Okay, but I don't agree with the guy.
You're saying that it can morally improve people?
Yeah, no. So the point is, if you ask me about the truth, I will tell you that type A of Judaism, forget you go to a reformer. It's not a reformer. It's not a Satmar.
Okay.
Right? Or a Ture Karta. So I could tell you, I think these people are wrong about this, 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 and this, and this. Right? But I can respect them for the good things that they do, et cetera, et cetera. But that is, pluralism is, in my view, the claim that my view is no better than the other guy's view. And he should believe that his view is no better than my view. Well, what kind of an idiot would live his life by not trying to live according to the view that he's right? So the notion that people have to not believe that they're right in order to make it possible to live with others is totally wrong. The person who believes in what he believes in is the one who can respect the other person. Now, some people haven't learned that yet. That's another problem. But is the one who can respect the other person. And therefore, right, so-called pluralism is a kind of you don't believe in anything yourself about your own point of view. So why are you doing that?
So actually, again, I want to split the two things apart because, again, it sounds to me like there's two different things at issue here. One is to say, you know, Bernard Lewis wrote an article after 9/11, and the title of the article was, I'm right, you're wrong, go to hell. Right? And that was his sort of rehearsing of sort of contemporary Islamist argument. That's one kind of believing I'm right. But then there's, I think I'm right, and because I only think I'm right, in other words, I can't be 100% sure that I'm right, then I can't be 100% sure that you're wrong, really. And those are two very different things, right? You're talking about, on the one hand, I agree with you, if somebody believes in something, you should believe that what you think is right. But what you do with that can be very, very different.
That's where what I call tolerance comes in. Once I've decided I know what I think, then I got to decide, how am I going to relate to the next person? Now, if the next person is Islamist saying wants to blow me up, then I'm going to relate to him one way. But if the person is my neighbor who goes to a different kind of a shul or a different kind of, or maybe to a church, I'm going to relate to him differently because why not? It's obvious. The difference is obvious. But, I just don't see the notion that a person would have to, in order to relate to another, would have to be willing to believe that the other guy is as correct as he is.
I guess I'm wondering if we can't know what we know. Now, I'll put it in very simple terms. If I really can't know that God gave Moshe the Torah at Sinai, can I really say the Christian is wrong about the story of the crucifixion and resurrection?
Let me put it to you this way, okay? Our problem with the Christians is not what they say about the crucifixion and resurrection. First of all, the crucifixion took place. Okay? That's not our problem. Our problem is, are they right or wrong about A, the Messiah came?
Right.
B, the Messiah is somehow, as I always put it, more divine than the rest of us, right? Which we think is impossible. And C, the abrogation of Jewish law. Now, that differs from the point that you said completely. Because the analogy is, if I can know that I believe that certain things that are in the Torah represent the divine will for the people of Israel, or in some cases for the whole world, right? So if that's the case, can I know that this person's theology is incorrect? And the answer is I can know it like the Rambam's knowledge, which is experiential and not necessarily factual. Now, once I know that from my point of view, I have a right to say that I think the other guy is wrong. I don't have a right to disrespect him, because if I can believe with no proof at all that the Jews came out of Egypt, which is in fact questioned by a lot of scholars, and with no proof at all, I can believe that that's true, when the only text that I have is a text which, at least in the version I have of it, has been passed down for a very long time, and then I have no right to say to my Christian neighbor, you're some kind of an idiot or a moron, and be intolerant of what he believes. Because what he believes is as provable or non-provable as what I believe. And I always get a kick about these Jews who say, you know, this is Christianity. No, it's not true. It's not true because they didn't. None of the sources from Jesus' own time say he existed. Now, A, it's probably not true. But leave that aside. But B, what are you, crazy? None of the sources from Moses' own time say he existed except the Bible. So if the other guy, if my guy existed, then why didn't his guy exist? It's nonsense, right? The point I'm making, though, is that that's the real analogy. And so you have no right to disrespect the other person from believing that something is true, which you don't believe is true. You have no right to disrespect them, but you have every right to disagree and say, no, I know from a religious point of view that X, Y, and Z is true, and I don't agree with you.
Okay.
See, I think there's a distinction. I hope so.
I'm thinking about it. It's going to take me a while to process. I want to thank you very much. And I'm going to ask people if they want to ask questions, but for now, if you could give Professor Schiffman a hand.
Oh.
Does anybody have anything they want to ask? No? Okay. Well, good night. Did you want to ask something? Just come up to the mic. Come up to the mic. Yeah. No, come up to the mic.
I just wanted to ask you that the whole thing about the not accepting Torah Shabbat, that Torah Shabbat Peh, I'm trying to remember exactly what you said, but the Rambam does say that you have to accept the Torah Shabbat Peh also in its complete state. So to say that, you know, we're only seeing it through the Torah Shabbat Peh, through the Torah Shabbat Peh, and therefore, well, the Torah Shabbat Peh, I think you made a statement, no one ever said that we have to believe exactly how the Torah Shabbat Peh was said. The Rambam does say that, I believe, in
no
his... maybe I misheard, but it seemed to be that you're saying the Torah Shabbat Peh is not something you have to believe in.
Okay, the first problem is, what is the entirety of the Torah Shabbat Peh? For the Rambam, the Torah Shabbat Peh does not include the Gemara. It's very important to understand this, right? The Torah Shabbat Peh consists, as he explains in the commentary in the Mishnah, consists of the anonymous portions of the Mishnah and Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai that's identified elsewhere, and maybe some other Tannaitic statements from the rabbis of the Mishnah that may represent undisputed things. Now, then he says, what you have to believe is that it was given at Sinai, but not that item A is in it and item B is in it. So, for example, if you find an argument in the Gemara about whether the Mishnah text should say A or B in an anonymous Mishnah, one guy is holding that this is part of Torah Shabbat Peh, these words. The other guy is holding it's not in his text. And every time you have chasori mechasra v'achi katani, something's missing in this Mishnah, doesn't mean what he means to teach. Well, wait a minute. If it's an anonymous Mishnah, the Rambam says Torah Shabbat Peh. So what's with these words? Are they given by God or not given by God, okay? So my point was that the Rambam does not say that if, for example, we say that according to Chazal, this, 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 and this are the work that you can't do on Shabbos, He doesn't say that if you disagree and hold another point of view, which is all over the Gemara, right, that list, there's a whole alternative to that list. Completely different alternative list is given there. And he doesn't say that if you believe that list A is correct, not list B, that you're a heretic. That's the point I was making. Now, and the notion, now, where you can get me is on the following statement. You know that when a person converts to Judaism, they have to imitate the process in which the Jews accepted Torah at Sinai. That's what the whole ritual is. First, you got to immerse, and then you got to do there, and you got to receive the Torah, all this stuff. Now, the halacha is, and it's a Tosefta, which is that if a person is going to convert, and they say they want to convert on condition that afil diktuk echad mik diktuk sofrim, one of the minor rabbinic views, they were willing to become a Jew, but they have a condition that one thing they don't accept. You have to say them, we're sorry, you can't become a convert. And you could argue that, well, this must be because every single thing that's in the tradition and believes comes Sinai. Right? You could argue that. That's correct. But you could argue that kind of approach there. I think ultimately what I meant to say is not that it isn't, again, with we asked the question, what are the basic beliefs? Basic belief of Judaism is that the Torah is not a self-standing law. You need an oral law to go with it. This, by definition, is non-fundamentalist. But I would agree with you that if you would make up your own new oral law type interpretations, that these things might be in the area that would be unacceptable. No question. Well, the question is whether or not one has to agree. Everybody here has a question. As an academic, could you really believe, you see, that all of these things in the Torah Shebal Peh are Torah B'Sinai? I think one has to admit that an academic approach to rabbinic literature will leave you with a smaller core of what is going to be considered the core of Torah Shebal Peh and a larger core of what's considered to be its historical development. However, the minute you'll come to such a conclusion, you'll find that you may be disagreeing with the Rambam, but not with a lot of other people, because there are, I would say, three basic points of view about the origins of Torah Shebal Peh. What you can call minimalist, middle of the road, and maximalist. Maximalist is fundamentalist. That says every word of the Gemara, it's very simple. Yeah, you see Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yishmael, they're arguing, doesn't matter, it was all known before. Okay, this the Rambam rejects this completely because he says they'd be morons to be sitting there all day, night, arguing if they already knew the answer. I mean, talking like they're kind of monkeys or something. Okay, so it doesn't mean it. Then, let's talk about the other points of view. The middle of the road position is the one that you've just been enunciating, which is, let's call it the average position, and it's basically the form of the Rambam. The minimalist position says things like, no, only the rules for interpreting the Torah were given, and the rest of it all comes from it. And in some way, if you read all the modern historical literature of Orthodox scholars who accept the idea that some kind of Torah Shebal Peh has some kind of ongoing origin back to God's giving the Torah to Israel, they all will minimize the amount of the stuff because so much of it is datable to later dates. But on the other hand, the question is that this is another example of these faith things, and I'll tell you why. One of the big issues that we face in this whole idea of understanding Torah Shebal Peh is whether or not the very words of Chazal about Torah Shebal Peh should be taken literally. So if you say, Kol Masha Talmid Vatik, right, whatever it is, Atid Lomar, whatever it is, Far Nitna L'Moshe M'Sinai, that everything which a later rabbi is ever going to say was already given to Moses at Sinai, is that meant as a historical fact? Or is that meant to be discussing the way in which it's all integrally connected back one to another? And even if we talk about the written Torah, the Rambam says that you have to believe that the whole Torah, as we have it now, is exactly the same as the Torah that was given to Moses on Sinai. Now, the fact is that if you read the Rambam all over the place, you will see that the Rambam actually contradicts that idea because he's aware of the development of the Masorah, etc., etc. And there's this interesting book by Rav Yaakov Weinberg about the 13 principles of the faith of all people. He says that this is manifestly not true. What does the Rambam mean here? So the point that I'm making is that sometimes these statements that are made in the Rambam and elsewhere may be intended as theological ways of understanding the history that unfolded and should not be seen as replacing that with an alternative history. And one of the big mistakes that we have today is the people who are against history or who say silly things about how things that we know are really true aren't true. They often do it by replacing history with theology. And our theology may be totally correct, along with a history that looks like it contradicts it. And it may be totally correct because it may explain the fact that we believe that that history is a working out of a divine process. And so to then get rid of the history and stick in the theology instead may be a falsification of even the view of Chazal.
What do you mean by sticking in the theology?
Well, in other words, like this, the example we're talking about right now.
Terms.
So somebody has a theological idea that the Torah text never changed. Well, we know that Chazal tell us about Tikkuni Sofrim, let's say. Certain corrections and changes and things that were made. Any idiot who opens up the Chumash, he sees that you have this word Tichorim for hemorrhoids that they didn't want to say, or Ophlim or whatever the word is, right? That is about hemorrhoids, and they took it out. It's mentioned elsewhere in the Bible because they didn't want people saying this word in public and told you to say a different word. And so we don't say this word. We say Tchorim, right? Anybody who looks at that, right, and then looks at what it says about Tikkuni Sofrim, where they speak about how the fact that certain changes were made in the text itself for reasons like that, can see that the Chazal tell you that the Torah given to Moshe is not the Torah you have in your Aaron Kodesh, let alone the change of the script and this and that everything. So what does it mean when you say this is exactly the same Torah? What you mean is like this. I'll teach you something now which is totally irrelevant, but really interesting. Everybody knows the statement I call Taloi b'mazal, afilu sefer Torah shebeichal. And you translate it, everything is connected with luck, except the sefer Torah. It's not what it means. I call Taloi, right, b'mazal, this is mazal, is from Nun Zayin Lamed. It's the flow of the divine spirit. Everything in our world only exists because of the fact that it's somehow connected to the divine. Afilu sefer Torah shebeichal. That the reason why every Torah has a sanctity is because every single Torah has got like a wire going to heaven. And that's the kind of thing that they're trying to teach us here. That every one of these Sifrei Torah that we have, that they didn't have blue cover with lions, doesn't matter, right? That Torah is the Torah we were given. But to substitute theology for history means to take that statement and say, when Moshe Rabbeinu came back down with the Torah, it was exactly written the way we write it now. Even though, by the way, anyone who knows that the lettering we use today is about 100 years old. And the reason it's 100 years old is because in the last 100 years, you had the kibbutz galuyot, and you had to figure out how to make it kosher for everyone. So in order to be kosher for Galicianers and Litvaks and Hungarians, according to all the poskim, they found a way to write the script with the chumras of all the groups. So they never did it that way. Tefillin were never made with an hydraulic press until 150 years ago. They didn't have these tefillin that we have of Or Echad. You couldn't make them. So what does all this mean? So if a person is going to be fooled into believing that Moshe Rabbeinu had the same ones that we had, no. But then we come and we say, but it is the same ones. You see? Because of the continuity of tradition. So you have to ask the question, what do we mean when he says the same one? And that's if you substitute theology for history, you think you can't know there was a change because after all, it's the same one. Oh, that's a more complicated. They both existed, Rosh and Ritter. Yeah.
Well, on that note, I hope all of our wires go to heaven. And thank you very much.